Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
We have a new face tonight. Welcome. I saw you all walking in together, so I made an assumption. I'm glad you're here. Let's do introductions around.
Judy.
Ron.
Miko.
Wendy.
Coffee.
Steve.
Leslie.
Dawn.
Jeffrey.
John.
Kathy.
Violet.
Weston. And Angie. So we are coming to the end of the Genjo Koan, except that there is no end to the Genjo Koan, ever. Please remember that. Many people memorize it because it's so interesting and beautiful and mysterious. And it can help you as you navigate the rough places just to remember. The moon in a dewdrop, or the birds in the air, or some other image that will free your mind. When we get stuck, it's our mind that gets stuck. And anything that can help us get unstuck is a wonder. So this, I think many people cherish as one of those kind of miracle collection of words that, though we can't say exactly what it says, we feel what it means. So we talked about the final story, which is a koan about Magu. And Magu is a tricky fellow. So the monk asks the question, and it was Dogen's question in a way, and Okamura talks about Dogen's question as he presented it to his teacher. And I think this is one of the most important things in this chapter, is this quotation from Dogen about, he brought this question all the way across the China Sea, and through years of wandering around China at looking for someone who knew the answer to, if all beings have Buddha nature, why do we need to practice? Why don't we just kick back and enjoy it? And yet, the practice is not like that at all. We do have to practice. And it didn't make sense to him. So Dogen said, teachers in the past and present have said that self-awareness is like a fish that knows whether water is cold or warm when it drinks it. This wisdom is awakening and the realization of enlightenment. I, Dogen, criticize this understanding. If self-awareness is the true awakening, then all living beings have such awareness. Because all living beings know themselves to be cold or warm, itchy or in pain, are they all Tathagatas, Buddhas, with true awakening? Some people answered, yes, all living beings are the original Tathagata from the beginningless beginning, and others said all living beings are not necessarily Tathagata Buddhas. Why is this so? If they know that self-awareness and natural wisdom are supreme awakening, They are Tathagatas. And if they do not know this, they are not Tathagatas. Are these opinions of the Buddha Dharma or not? Poor teacher. Poor Juching. This little guy from Japan comes in and asks a heavy-duty question. Chantong Rujing answered Dogen's question in this way. If people say that all living beings are from the beginning Buddhas, they're the same as the non-Buddhists of naturalness. Comparing the self and the attributes of the self to Buddhas is nothing other than considering those who have not yet attained to be as those who have attained, and those who are not enlightened to be as those who are enlightened. So it's not like that. We can't say that understanding and self-awareness is true awakening is not in accordance with the Buddha's teachings. Rujing taught that we cannot see reality and practice only from absolute perspective. So thinking that all beings have Buddha nature or are Buddha nature puts us in the absolute realm. And it's a very spacey place, and it's only half. Because it's all ordinary at the same time. We say form doesn't differ from emptiness. This is talking about form, being form. But emptiness being the same as form. So it's one of those situations where we really can't say, because it's both and. And that's why Dogen was confused, because the people practicing in Japan put us all in the absolute realm, up in the heavenly realm. And when you practice like that, it's a very intense and wonderful kind of practice, but it's very unreal. You're not in touch with the ground, not in touch with ordinariness, which is what everything is. Every enlightened monk is an ordinary person at the same time. And it's so easy to think when you have, especially if you've been sitting a long time and have a special experience, that you are special in some way and are more in touch with the absolute than everybody else. It's so easy to be caught by all these different ideas about practice. But what this is saying is that practice, the life of practice, is just practicing. Just that and nothing else. And practice means sitting. Sitting and experiencing everything that is experienced in sitting. It's the blah, blah, blah of the mind. It's the quiet places that come between the blah, blah, blahs. It's the insights that come sometimes big ones like a blast. And then it's just the ordinary breath, in and out, in and out, in and out. It's all practice. It's life. It's life of the bird and life of the fish. He quotes Fukansa Zengi, a big paragraph of it that I will share with you. It's called Universal Recommendations for Zazen, and it's very important. Originally, the way is complete and universal. How can we distinguish practice from enlightenment? The vehicle of reality is in the self. Why should we waste our efforts trying to attain it? Still more, the whole body is free from the world's dust. Why should we believe in a means to sweep it away? The way is never separated from where we are now. Why should we wander here and there to practice? Yet, if there is the slightest deviation, you will be as far from the way as heaven is from earth. If adverse or favorable conditions arise to even a small degree, you will lose your mind in confusion. Moreover, consider Shakyamuni Buddha, who was enlightened from birth. To this day, you can see the traces of his sitting in the upright posture for 6 years. And Bodhidharma, who transmitted the mind seal, even now you can hear of the fame of his facing the wall for 9 years. These ancient sages practiced in this way. How can you people of today refrain from practice? We read this every morning when I was in Japan with a group of local women, where we practiced at Suzuki Roshi's temple. And when we got to the part about why should we wander here and there to practice, we were sitting there in Japan, miles and miles, and we always laughed. We don't need to be here. It's already. So I thought I would read the whole thing to you one more time, because it's very short, and it's sort of the denouement is to hear the whole thing and then talk a little bit about the koan at the end. Of course, I have to find it first. When all dharmas, all things, all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization. Practice, life and death, Buddhas and living beings. When the 10,000 dharmas are without fixed self, there is no delusion and no realization, no Buddhas and no living beings, no birth and no death. If things aren't stuck. Since the Buddha way by nature goes beyond the dichotomy of abundance and deficiency, there is arising and perishing, delusion and realization, living beings and Buddhas. Therefore, flowers fall even though we love them, and weeds grow even though we dislike them. Conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. Furthermore, there are those who attain realization beyond realization, and those who are deluded within delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive that they're Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas, and they continue actualizing Buddha. In seeing color and hearing sound with body and mind, although we perceive them intimately, the perception is not like reflections in a mirror or the moon in water. When one side is illuminated, the other is dark. If we're all involved in the gorgeousness of the life and world of body-mind, the other side is dark. So we're always moving from one side to the other. And the moon, as you know, doesn't just go black and white. It goes to all different degrees. So we're always changing as our life goes through is effort to try to understand and connect. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. There is a trace of realization that can't be grasped, and we endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. Can't touch it. Can't touch it. When one first seeks the Dharma, one strays far from the boundaries of the Dharma. When the Dharma is correctly transmitted to the self, one is immediately an original person. If one riding in a boat watches the coast, one mistakenly perceives the coast as moving. If one watches the boat in relation to the surface of the water, then one notices that the boat is moving. Similarly, when we perceive the body and mind in a confused way and grasp all things with a discriminating mind, we mistakenly think that the self-nature of the mind is permanent. When we intimately practice and return right here, it's clear that all things have no fixed self. We can look around the room and see so. We can see it. Firewood becomes ash. Ash cannot become firewood again. However, we shouldn't view ash as after and firewood as before. We should know that firewood dwells in the Dharma position of firewood and has its own before and after. Although before and after exist, past and future are cut off. Ash stays in the position of ash with its own before and after. As firewood never becomes firewood again after it has burned to ash, there is no return to living after a person dies. However, in Buddha Dharma, it is an unchanged tradition not to say that life becomes death. Therefore, we call it no arising. It is the established way of Buddha's turning the Dharma wheel not to say that death becomes life. Therefore, we call it no perishing. Life is a position in time. Death is also a position in time. This is like winter and spring. We don't think that winter becomes spring. And we don't say that spring becomes summer. When the person attains realization, it's like the moon's reflection in water. The moon never becomes wet, the water is never disturbed. Although the moon is a vast and great light, it is reflected in a drop of water. The whole moon and even the whole sky are reflected in a drop of dew on a blade of grass. Realization does not destroy the person, as the moon does not make a hole in the water. The person does not obstruct realization, as a drop of dew doesn't obstruct the moon in the sky. The depth is the same as the height. The length and brevity of time, we should consider whether water is great or small, and understand the size of the moon in the sky. When the Dharma has not yet fully penetrated body and mind, one thinks one already is filled with it. When the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking. Remember this. It comes up over and over. We think we should feel finished, and there's always something off. Koban's teacher told him, always be like a table with one leg slightly shorter than the rest. Always be a little wobbly. When the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking. For example, when we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. This great ocean, however, is neither round nor square. It has inexhaustible characteristics. To a fish, it looks like a palace. To a heavenly being, a jeweled necklace. To us, as far as eyes can see, it looks like a circle. All the myriad things are like this. Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics, and we only see or grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. This is just like the experiment at Harvard when the young fellow had to look at the fish and the pickled fish and write down everything he could discover about the fish for the professor. And when he had done that all day long, he gave the list to the professor and he said, "Oh, that's fine, come back tomorrow and do it some more." And he kept having to write about all the characteristics of the fish, and the professor said at the end, "You can see there is no end to this fish, no end to knowing all that there is to know about every single thing." When we listen to the reality of myriad things, we must know that there are inexhaustible characteristics in both ocean and mountains, and there are many other worlds in the four directions. This is true not only in the external world, but also right under our feet or within a single drop of water. He knew that before the microscope. When a fish swims, no matter how far it swims, it doesn't reach the end of the water. When a bird flies, no matter how high it flies, it cannot reach the end of the sky. When the bird's need or the fish's need is great, the range is large. When the need is small, the range is small. In this way, each fish and each bird uses the whole of space and vigorously acts in every space. However, if a bird departs from the sky or a fish leaves the water, it immediately dies. We should know that for a fish, water is life. For a bird, sky is life. A bird is life. A fish is life. Life is a bird. Life is a fish. And we should go beyond this. There is practice enlightenment, and this is the way of living beings. This is our way. Therefore, if there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. When we make this very place, our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality. Our place becomes Genjo Koan. When we make this very place our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality. This path, this place, is neither big nor small, neither self nor others. It has not existed before this moment, nor has it come into existence now. Therefore, the reality of all things is thus. In the same way, when a person engages in practice enlightenment in the Buddha way, as the person realizes one Dharma, the person permeates that Dharma. As the person encounters one practice, the person fully practices that practice. For this, there is a place and a path. The boundary of the known is not clear. This is because the known, which appears limited, is born and practiced simultaneously with the complete penetration of the Buddha Dharma. We should not think that what we have attained is conceived by ourselves and known by our discriminating mind. Although complete enlightenment is immediately actualized, its intimacy is such that it does not necessarily form as a view. In fact, viewing is not something fixed. We see, and then we see something else, and then we see again, and we're seeing more and more. Every moment is a view. Again, we can't get stuck because it's always moving. So Zen Master Baoche of Mount Magu was waving a fan, and a monk approached him and asked, "The nature of wind is ever present and permeates everywhere. Why are you waving a fan?" The master said, "You know only that the wind's nature is ever present. You don't know that it permeates everywhere." The monk said, "How does wind permeate everywhere?" The master just continued to wave his fan. La 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 la. The genuine, says this Dogen, the genuine experience of Buddha Dharma. Oh, the monk bowed deeply. I should add that because that's important. He didn't just blink. He bowed very deeply. The genuine experience of Buddha Dharma and the vital path that has been correctly transmitted are like this. To say we should not wave a fan because the nature of wind is ever present, and that we should feel the wind even when we don't wave a fan, is to know neither ever presence nor the wind's nature. Since the wind's nature is ever present, the wind of the Buddha's family enables us to realize the gold of the great earth and to transform the water of the long river into cream. So I won't say much more. The emphasis on the monk bowing is because that too is waving a fan. Mm-hmm. It's, in other words, this is not an idea, this is an action. That the truth of things is always a result of our own action. That we gin it up ourselves, you could say, in a crude kind of way. And that's the only way it is. It's the only way. It's not out there. It's not in a great big book. It's nowhere else. It's just right here, right now, in you and me. So Okamura says, like the water for fish and the sky for birds, the great earth symbolizes the world we live in. And the water of the long river symbolizes the stream of our lives. The wind of the Buddha's family is the product of our ceaseless practice of vow and repentance, which is firmly rooted in Shikan Zaza, or just sitting. This ceaseless practice makes our world as precious as gold and our lives as rich as cream. Here again, Dogen reveals the self and the world of the self, the 10,000 things, as they really are, totally interdependent. It's all of a piece. We're not individuals. We're swimming in the same soup. So he ends by saying, our Zazen practice enables us to reverse this fundamentally upside-down view of the self and the world. And our bodhisattva vows then become the guidelines for a life lived together with all beings. When we become aware that our practice is incomplete and we've strayed from the bodhisattva path, we practice repentance and return to our vows. Repentance meaning just acknowledgement, just waking up and saying, oh, look at that, I just told a lie. I didn't mean to do that, but I did it. Better take it back. Just simple things like that. And then we can return to our vows. This is the way our bodhisattva practice enriches our life endlessly. Endlessly, just like the birds in the sky. So thank you, Shohaku Okamura. Thank you, Dogen. Thank all of you. You all have said some very interesting things about this, and maybe you have more interesting things to say. Are there questions or comments? You sure? Ron?
Did you mention something about the koan at the end of it?
Mm-hmm.
Or did you already tell us?
It's the one about the fan.
Oh, the fan.
Yes. Yeah. It's one of the many, many. And Dogen uses koans all through his writing. We all say in Soto Zen we don't do koans. That's for Rinzai Zen. But we do koans. We just do them in a different way. We don't sit with them and agonize over them for days and months and years. which some people cherish as a wonderful practice. So... But we don't do that. Anything else?
Yeah. So what you just said, so does that mean in Soto Zen we don't focus on the koans, we just sit and let the koans do their work? Is that what you meant, or meant something else?
It's more about the insight that it requires in order to understand a koan, because usually they're mysterious, and yet underneath them they're saying something. So it's not a requirement in Soto Zen to enact the understanding of the koan, which you do in Rinzai, but you it's used to help you understand what's trying to be expressed. The mystery of what's being expressed. He calls it the wind. He doesn't say what the wind is in this koan, but we feel what that is. Yeah. And it's more powerful that way. Yes.
Let's see if I can get this straight. So when you talk about people who agonize over the meaning of the koan, that sounds like suffering.
Well, it is. It can be. It's hard, but there's no guarantee that practice is going to take away suffering. Mm. It's just to recognize suffering and its source, so we can face it more honestly and clearly with a clear mind rather than in confusion. Good question. Yes, John.
So, I very much like what you mentioned about absolute and ordinary. And then shortly after, you refer to emptiness as form and form as emptiness. And so I think this means that absolute is ordinary and ordinary is absolute.
No.
No.
No. Form is form and absolute is absolute. I know. It is that way.
Is form emptiness?
Yes.
And what is absolute?
Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, and the same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness, meaning all the elements of human being. So it's not just form, it's all those other aspects of being alive, that we in our life are exemplifying the life of ordinary being as absolute, or exemplifying absolute as ordinary being, and that's wrong. I just said a wrong thing, but that's as close as I can get. You can't say it. In Zen we say not one, not two. And our minds just go like that. It doesn't like it. Thank you. Yes, we all struggle on that one, and struggle for our whole life. Jeffrey?
Yes. It's how we experience and enjoy that struggle. So I heard a very interesting expression from a Sufi poem today on a podcast as I was heading for a memorial for a friend. And it was, "Oh Lord, let me be amplified by bewilderment. Let it be more intense," which I thought was really interesting. It wasn't a talk given by a Sufi master, it was Alan Sinaki. And I found it really interesting because he was talking about the mystery, mm-hmm. and how bewilderment puts
yes.
us in that direction. And he talks about, you know, as an educator, we've always been interested in what's comprehensive, what we can understand. But this practice draws you to the incomprehensible, to the great mystery.
Yes.
And the longer I've been in the practice, the more I am drawn to that. Mm-hmm. And today when you go to a memorial, you know, and you have your friend of 25 years is in a coffin with a flag draped over it, and you think about this great mystery.
You think about it
so deeply.
Yes.
It's really, it took me in a really deeper place today. So grateful that, and I was really thinking about how grateful I am that I get to sit, because part of like every time you, one of the great things he said on this day was that when you sit down, you know, for 30 minutes or 40 minutes and you get up, nobody rushes to a journal and writes down what they experience. I'm a great journalist, you know. I've never written a sentence that deals with what I, you know, what,
right.
How was my meditation? It could because it's...
It's ineffable.
It's that flow.
Yes.
Which reminds me about another poet, Jim Harrison, who I didn't realize was he's a novelist, a well-known American novelist who passed about a year ago. And Jim said, after City, for some time, that he worked out to get strong so that he could be just like water and flow down over boulders to enjoy the downward dance. Yeah. Really like that.
He was a student of Coben's. I knew him. I knew him. Dan Gerber and Jim Harrison. There was a third one, wasn't there, Don?
What's that?
There were three guys who hung out together at Haiku Zendo.
I only remember Trout and a couple of the other guys, but it's three. I can't remember who else.
Yeah, it was people from far away, so Jim was not from there, California, neither was Dan.
No, Jim Harrison was from the UP, Upper Peninsula.
Yes, he spent years and years up there. Yeah, my favorite place.
Oh my goodness, I had no idea that you knew him.
Yeah.
I mean, other than, reading his books.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thank you very much for
sharing. Oh, thank you. So I don't have a watch as usual.
It's 9 after.
I hope we're all thinking about what to study next, because we can study something next. We don't have to. I can come up with something every time, some new thing that fascinates me, the way I do at IMC. But you may want to study some particular thing that you haven't had a chance to look into, or you want to look into again, because the again part is really important also. If it's real, it will be new. Even if you see it many times, it's still new. So think about it. I'll be in the mountains next week. Speaking of Trout, Sylvia are going to take me up into the mountains for a few days. So John will be here, and I will be back the next week. So I'm excited.
Be safe.
Questions? Announcement. Everything's a buzz about Sesshin, so there's a lot going on. The whole menu is ready. Nico?
I'll say that if anybody has not registered, we still have slots open.
Good.
So,
good.
Register.
But there's a good crowd already signed up.
We've got 18. 17, 19.
Perfect. It's perfect.
It's around there.
Yes. Yeah. Just right. Okay. 1 minute sit.